Welcome, welcome, welcome. This is the Distraction Pieces Podcast, episode 257. Thank you all for tuning in, guys. Hope you're all well. Really special one this week. I've been hyping it for a month or so now. Before we get into it, thank you for all the love for the recent episodes. The Stephen Knight episode last week, which involved a lot of information on Peaky Blinders and Taboo and Tom Hardy and Cillian Murphy. And all sorts of wonderful stuff. And the week before, the Stephen Merchant episode has gone crazy. It's currently the most popular episode of the year. So thank you for all the love. And the Mary J. Blige one from a few weeks before was also wonderful reaction. So thank you all for tuning in and keeping listening. Before I get into this week's episode, I will tell you that... by now, we should have restocked the ever-sold-out sunglasses at speechdevelopmentrecords.com. But I'm not going to go on about that for ages. You don't have to skip past this bit. But I will mention that on Monday, it's part two of the Distraction Pieces Rewind, where I go over previous Distraction Pieces podcast episodes and give a bit of a behind-the-scenes chat and story. They're normally between half hour and an hour long. And they're available at patreon.com/scroobiuspip. It's only a dollar. Once you subscribe, you probably won't notice a dollar each month going out of your account. If it was five or ten, I wouldn't say you wouldn't notice it. I'd say you may find it good value. You may choose to spend it, but a dollar is nice and small amount, and you get Distraction Pieces Podcast Rewind. And you get poem of the month at the beginning of the month. And you get previews of all the upcoming guests. Speaking of which, when I posted about today's episode on the Patreon, it's been the most popular post of the year so far. It's had the most likes and the most comments because this week's guest is PC Leon McLeod. We mentioned him on the Drunk Cast and we were drunk and made a mess of everything. We couldn't pronounce his name right. Yeah, to give a little bit of backstory, I won't go into tons of detail because we talk about it in the podcast, obviously, but we leave a key part out in the podcast. So I'll give a quick... Basically, Liam was one of the first responders on the London Bridge terror attack. It was Leon and two mates of his... or actually, one he knew and one he hadn't really met before, but yeah. And that's, you know... amazing and huge, and I was informed a little while after that to commemorate that day he got a tattoo of some of my lyrics, and that blew me away. And we talk about all of it in the podcast, but we don't actually say what the lyrics were, so I thought I'd tell you in the start. I had a song with Dan Lesac on our second album called Cowboy. In fact, I'll tell you a little bit about that song in the outro. I don't want to feel the intro too much because this is an amazing chat. But the lyrics on the last verse of that song go, "See, that is London and that is Britain. We may get scratched and we may get bitten, but even when our heart and resolve is depleted, we won't lay down. No, we won't be defeated." Yeah. So, I mean, years on to have that put in such a... insane tribute from such an amazing individual blew me away. But we talk about all that in the podcast. I just wanted to give you the lyrics here. We talk about how we met for the first time. We Are Lizards, in fact, which returns at the end of the month on Saturday, March 30th. And we've got the wonderful Simone from Primal Scream coming and spinning some tunes for us. So come down to that. Anyway, let's jump into the podcast because it's a hell of a story. And Leon was... man, he was amazingly open and honest about the events, humble about his involvement in the events, repeatedly stating he still doesn't feel he deserves any particular credit for it, but really humblingly open about the after effects of it all, I guess. But let's jump into it. This is episode 220, is it 220? Seven or 237? No, it's 257. What am I talking about? Well, that was a smooth into the podcast bit. This is episode... also, before we go into it, podcasts that don't have a big celebrity name attached to them really, it makes a difference if you guys shout about it on social media and just privately on word of mouth to your mates. So, yeah, if you enjoy this one, please shout about it. On these ones as well, I'm always overwhelmed by the reaction on socials, but I'm also always likely to give them a good share and a good push because, you know, if it says Stephen Merchant on there, people are going to download it. If it says piece of Leon McLeod and there's not, and you know, you can't instantly hear what the story is in the title, then it needs pushing and it needs you guys spreading the words. And this is what the Distraction Pieces podcast is about these episodes. It's great that, you know, I get approached all the time to have big Hollywood stars on these days, which is mad, to have Mary J. Blige and Stephen Merchant and Joel Egerton and all these other people that we've had this year alone is mind-blowing. But what it's about is the people with just amazing stories as well, not purely based on your level of fame or whatever else. So yeah, please help spread the word on this and make it clear that these are worth doing and are worth shouting about. That's the beauty of podcasts. I'm getting all rambly, so I'll stop. This is episode 257 of the Distraction Pieces podcast. This piece of fiction is the intro to Distraction Pieces. This piece of fiction is the intro to Distraction Pieces. This piece of fiction is the intro to Distraction Pieces. This piece of fiction is the intro to Distraction Pieces. So yeah, I'll put my phone on airplane mode.
On airplane mode.
Good work. I forgot mine right on it. For a second. The biggest tool I've learned in the last, I've probably been doing it for 6 months or so now, is that I turn my iPhone to never go to sleep.
Right.
If that makes sense. So my notes are there and they stay there.
Because it doesn't go, I know what you mean.
So many podcasts for years, having to reopen it, having to put my thumbprint.
Looking away. Looks like you're being really rude.
Or whatever else. Yeah, exactly. And then I was like, I must have gone on someone else's podcast and they did that. And I was like, that's clever.
That's genius.
That's a good idea.
See, I'd never thought to do that. Not with my friends at work. You don't want to leave your phone sort of unlocked for any amount of time.
Same it's a computers. Dangerous one. Exactly. Well, I'll kick things off and introduce you, but I'm going to, we'll discuss it, because of appalling drunk cast mispronunciations, I'm going to let you say your name and then I'll learn.
I was really impressed. I was really impressed with your pronunciation, actually. It was I think there was two or three different types, but yeah, it's McLeod, Leon McLeod.
McLeod. And yeah. I listened back to that chunk of the drunk cast because, again, it's a heavy subject. I wanted to make sure it's ridiculous that we left it till we were 3 episodes in and hammered to tackle
it. It worked somehow, though. It did work.
But I listened to that, and at one point, Chris calls you Liam. And then after that, I can tell I'm saying Leon, but all I could hear was Liam. So it feels like there's a whole chunk of us calling you Liam.
I'm not diva-ish about these type of things, man. So no. It's sweet.
So I've been really excited about this, and I'm glad that you could come on. Anyone who's listened to that part of the drunk cast will kind of know the story. But I thought I'd kick things off by kind of telling the story of how I heard about you and how we ended up being kind of put in touch. I got a DM on Instagram, and weirdly, I hardly ever look at DMs. So I don't
too many
check
to go
them.
Through.
Yeah, and for some reason, I looked at this one, and it was a friend of yours who wanted to remain anonymous at the time. I believe you now know who
I
it was.
I do know, indeed, yeah.
And they just said, look, a mate of mine, Leon, was one of the first 3 police officers responding on the Tower Bridge.
London Bridge,
I'm getting it wrong already. attack in 2017. Mm. And he got a tattoo of some of your lyrics to kind of commemorate that. And they just kind of said it'd be great if you could drop them a message or something like that. And so I did that because I was just blown away. I was moved. And then we kind of had a bit of a back and forth over DMs.
Did indeed.
Both quite excited. and then you came along to our club night and we got to meet. So, yeah, that's kind of
it's a very good night as well.
How we were, how we got in touch, I guess.
Yeah, it was that was really random. I'm not going to lie. When you obviously the request to follow, you know, Scrooge McPippa's requested to follow you, I was like, is this a wind up? And I think I mentioned to you at a club night, I'd literally signed up to your Patreon on that morning.
Yeah.
Because I'd been meaning to do it for a while, and I was just walking into work, and I was listening to the podcast, like I do anyway, and I was like, oh, right, finally signed up to it. So on the train into work, I signed up, and then you started following me. I was like, oh, is this some sort of...
It's a good service, right?
Yeah, like, wow, that's like a bit stalkerish, but fair play. And then I was literally going to write a message as well, like, going, oh, my God, like, I love you, dude. and then suddenly you sent a message, and genuinely, I was sitting at work with my colleague, Anwar, and I was like, I can't open this message because I'm a bit... It was too weird. It was too surreal.
Yeah.
I hadn't slept very much. I'd been on early turn at work. I was like, I can't open this yet because I don't know what it's going to say. But it was mad.
I love stuff like that.
It was mad.
And not to compare myself at all, but when I was on set, I think it was on my first day of filming Walk Like a Panther, me and Guz Khan were sitting there waiting around, and there's hours of waiting around on films. And I had my phone, and a notification came up saying, it was an email notification, and the name on the top of the email was Samuel L. Jackson.
Ridiculous.
And I kind of looked at it, and I was exactly the same. I was like, I've got to leave that until we've done this scene to open that. Like, I need to focus on the scene and all this, because I'm like... And again, I assumed, I was like, that can't be... It must be just someone using the name
or
whatever.
Some weird spam, yeah.
And then end up I'm looking at it, and it was actual Samuel L. Jackson that was emailing me out of the blue. I've never met him, and it was about a charity thing. But yeah, I had that exact thing of...
You've got to prepare yourself.
So excited to get it, but I was like, I can't take that just now.
Yeah,
I'm going to leave it a bit, and then I'll...
Yeah, man, it was...
Oh, look at that.
That was a strange old day. It was a very weird day, and I was like, whoa.
Yeah.
And but, then, settled down now.
And then it turned out at the club night that you're a fan of the Hardcore Listing Lads as well.
Yeah.
So it was kind of a really exciting night for all of us, because I'd told the boys your story, which again, obviously, we're going to get into.
Yeah.
So they were excited to meet you, and they couldn't believe that you listened to their nonsense.
It's weird for me that then you guys were like excited to meet me. That really, I'll probably go into it at some point. I'm normal, like, well, ish. I guess my colleagues might work again would disagree, but to be, when you guys were like genuinely excited to see me, and obviously, I've spoken to Chris and Stu since as well. It's weird. It's so surreal to me. It's not what. I'm supposed to be doing, I suppose. It's just odd.
it's the weird world of podcasting, though,
exactly,
right? That you, as podcasters, you almost forget that people are listening.
Yeah,
it's a weird thing to get your head round. So when it turns out they are, then it is this overwhelming and moving thing.
That's the good thing about the drunk cast, though, when you say, because it is just mates. And then that was the really cool thing for me. Obviously, when I come down and met you guys, you're just normal. You're just mates. Like, oh, okay, this is cool. And again, that just makes everything, even like today, a lot more relaxed, because it's not like, oh my God, I'm going to meet this person.
Yeah,
it's like, oh, it's just Pip. Like, he's all right.
it's perfect, because the club night is kind of, it was the pre-drunk cast. I started the drunk cast because I thought the conversations that me, Chris and Stu have standing outside the club night every month were just amusing. And I was like, this will be an easy thing to just, we'll go and get drunk and do that. So it's weird that those things are the two introductions as such in that way, because that's how it came about.
It works. It was very cool. A very cool night. It was good to kind of chat to Chris and Stu as well. So it was awesome. I was disappointed that I'd left it so long to attend, because obviously that's the first one I've been to as well. But
man, it happens a lot. And again, it's mad how much the podcast has improved. I mean, we've always had good attendance, but it's even busier than ever now. And we get more people coming up who are like, oh, I heard about it on the podcast.
Yeah.
It's like, you'd think the music career would be a more natural
match to
the club night, because they're the same realm.
Yeah,
but
a
thing of me sitting and talking to people has made people come and get drunk and dance.
As long as they're coming, that's all that matters.
Yeah, exactly. As long as they're getting in the door. But
absolutely.
Obviously, you know, one of the reasons it's not easy for you to attend such things is your job.
Indeed,
because you've got shifts and things like that.
We don't get many Saturdays off.
No, exactly. So I want to talk about how you chose that path and what was your route there. But before, as we've been talking about, are you listening to podcasts?
Mm.
Where do you listen to podcasts? Is it on the way to work?
Literally, quite a lot of time. So if I'm going on a long car journey, I'll always listen to podcasts. But 90% of the time, it's kind of to and from work.
It literally, it's changed long car journeys,
isn't
it?
Because
for me, completely, I used to hate having to go to pick up merch, all these other things.
Yeah.
And now it's like, if I've got a backlog of good podcasts, it's not a thing.
That's exactly it. So, like, in my my previous job, I used to work in an office, and what can I say, I wasn't the most social all the time. So a lot of the time then it was a case of I'll be listening to him at work.
Yeah.
And it was the one problem when I started with the police and he was doing a lot of training, suddenly it was like, oh, I can't listen to podcasts during the day anymore.
Yeah.
So it just become my normal routine. Now, like I say, any long car journeys, any journey into work, unless I've kind of got a new album or something.
Yeah, yeah.
But yeah, man, it's just, I'm just obsessed with podcasts. It's a bit nerdy, but it's cool, man.
I love it. I love it. So what was your route into the police force? Because you said you had worked in offices and stuff like that before. So kind of what made you decide that it was something that you wanted to do? Because in recent years, the police force have had mixed press.
Mm.
I mean, more so in America with some of the things going on. And it's always been a weird conflict for me because I'm massively a supporter of the people and the average man on the street and things like that. But equally, my granddad was a policeman and he was one of the good guys. So my idea on the solution to the negative or any negative opinions people have of the police, the solution is to get good people in those roles, right? To get, rather than say, oh, I hate the police, say, well, or they're all bad or whatever else.
Yeah.
How do we get more people, or again, the racist accusations, again, a lot in America, your people may not know from the podcast, but you're a black guy.
So
it is kind of, it's that, it's positive things to go, well, rather than sit there going, well, they hate me, go, well, I'm going to go and improve that. I'm going to go and be part of that.
It's like an unfortunate, awkward thing where negative experiences with police and anything like that always leaves that kind of more memorable mark than a positive one. And,
of course.
And I get it. And, like, you know, I'm normal, so I'm going to sit here and be honest. Like, I've seen people kind of, you know, I know there's not every police officer's the best in the world.
Yeah. It's mad, though, because everyone that the majority. I actually know and have actually met, is amazing.
Exactly.
It's really, and, I can sit down and have reasoned conversations
absolutely.
And discuss complex things
and
it not
completely.
Be this, well, here's the law, that's that. It's
exactly. And it, but it's just, unfortunate that it's always the negative things that a lot of the time end up in the press in terms of policing.
Of
course. And, you know, I think I do my job pretty well. I try to not, I don't think I'm unfair or anything like that. I think one of the things that kind of helped me, so, I mean, obviously you asked a question about how I kind of got into it. So I wanted to join when I was 18. I think, if I'm being honest, I enjoyed school. It was really cool, but I wasn't very academic, shall we say.
Yeah, sure.
Got through my GCSEs and then stayed on and done A-levels just because, don't know, I didn't really know what else I wanted to do.
That's what you're meant to do, isn't it?
Exactly, like a lot of other people do anyway. And then, when I turned 18, I did apply to join the Met. I mean, I can imagine my application was awful.
Right.
Just because I wouldn't have had any kind of life experiences. You have to put a lot of things to it, and I wouldn't have had anything to put to it, basically.
Right.
So I could say, then I started working for my stepdad's plumbing company at the time. Went from there to working in this office job, like I said, I was doing before. It started off as a logistics thing, sending out their courses. And then I sort of ended up editing these courses for them. Like it's not that interesting, I'll be honest.
Sure.
And basically, I was kind of settling down. I had a long-term partner. And we were kind of planning for the future and looking to buy a house and just start thinking, like, what do I actually want to do? And I never felt like 9 to 5 was for me. It just never, it was, I know there's probably a lot of people that wake up on a Monday morning like, oh, I can't stand this, but I genuinely was like, this is not right for me. So I started thinking about it and I had quite a few friends who were in the police force as well. And so kind of suddenly got that little idea in my head. And then, I mean, there's a lot of effort you have to put into the application. It's not just a quick sort of 10-minute thing. It took hours and days and just a lot of effort that went into writing this application and get into the interview stage and stuff. And
that's really interesting.
I
love that it was what you wanted to do from the start, but you had to go and live a bit of life before you could
absolutely.
Do it. That's a fascinating thing. Where were you growing up? Was it South London?
I was born in Dartford, so
you should probably
hate me being an Essex lad. But so I was born in Dartford and then kind of grew up. It's kind of the outskirts of South East London, like around Bexley Heath, Belvedere.
We'll discuss later your incorrect choices in South London, but
we'll
get to that.
Steady.
But yeah. But yeah, so how was it kind of putting together that that kind of application. And did you feel at this point that you were ready?
Whereas
you could maybe look back at when you first applied and thought, that version of wasn't ready. I'm glad not. I didn't get in there.
I think, you know, I'll be really honest. I think if the wrong type of person, and it's not everyone, because I know there were people on my intake that were sort of 18, sort of between 18 and 21. And I think if the wrong type of person joins at such a young age, you can become quite institutionalised. And, you know, I think I would have, at 18, that would have been me. And, you know, you don't know where it's going to kind of lead you off on life, but on a personal way, I'm quite happy with how it panned out.
So when you did apply and when you got accepted,
what
was the process there? And do you kind of, the way I look at it is, I guess it's kind of, is it like college type thing where you have to choose an area that you're going into?
Not initially. So you join just as a sort of police constable.
Yeah.
I think there are certain ways in that you can go as DCs and stuff now, but you join as a police constable. So obviously, like I say, I was doing the application and I knew I was doing the right thing then because I was genuinely getting really excited about this, you know, doing this thing.
Yeah.
It's odd because I didn't have any previous policing experience. I've not been a PCSO, I've not been a special or anything like that, but I was kind of just really, I don't know, it just felt right.
So is that quite a common thing as well that people do the more, the volunteer type?
A lot of people do, yeah.
So, and that'll get their experience to then...
Yeah, I think, so in total, my intake was 40 people and, you know, a good probably 30, 40% of them had, well, probably even more actually, had some previous bit as a special or PCSO. There was quite a lot.
Yeah.
In a weird way, I was quite happy to join with nothing because then when you're learning the law side of things, you can kind of just get it as that rather as when you're a PCSO and you've got different powers and the special, I guess there's certain different things that you can and can't do.
Right.
So it was quite, I think it was quite beneficial to me just to be able to go, right, this is, you know, this is my job, that's what I do. Obviously I'm in the British Transport Police, so we have 22 weeks training over in Highbury and Islington. Literally, you're just kind of going through law and then you have all your sort of officer safety training and the thing that we have to do on top of sort of what Home Office forces do is we have to do track safety as well, which is another couple of weeks. But and then once you do that, you start going out and you have an 8 weeks tutoring phase, which is just where you've kind of got someone looking after you. And
is it anything like Training Day starring Denzel Washington?
Not quite. You know, there's probably similarities, but it's quite, basically the 8 weeks is really important after you come out because obviously in this kind of learning environment, that's where you're taught all the law.
Yeah.
When you go out and do the 8 weeks, that's when you're kind of taught this is actually how you do the job and this is how you apply things. And like the biggest thing for me, again, like I'd done the 22 weeks and I'd done all right with the kind of studying and stuff, but I was very aware that doesn't mean I'm necessarily going to be any good at the job because there's loads of people that have got all the knowledge, but then when it comes to being able to talk to somebody and being able to apply it, it's not that simple. So I was very aware of that. But again, I think I was quite lucky with who I got tutored by. He was really good. We're still pals now. So
that's great.
Yeah, I think I was pretty... I just think I was lucky, really. It's everything kind of come together and it was good timing and, it worked out all right.
So how was it on those kind of first days? Because I'd imagine no matter how much training you've had, it's still a nerve-wracking thing.
Completely.
And equally, whilst the public don't know that you're new, you know that this is your first time
out.
To be
fair,
it's your first time in that
situation. They can probably tell because you've got a really shiny yellow vest that's it just reeks of I'm new, I'm fresh out of the box.
I'm new here.
But it was nerve-wracking. I think my first shift was a Sunday, and then I had a couple of days off anyway, which probably sort of just helped me settle in.
Yeah.
But it was exciting.
Yeah.
I think I got in about an hour early just because you're like, I don't know, I didn't know what the kind of process was. So you're just trying to learn as you go a little bit. So just got in really early. My tutor wasn't even in yet for a long time. And then, I think we ended up actually going for breakfast for a little while and he sort of just shows you some of the systems, the computer systems, because as much as you're taught when you're learning, you don't use them. So it was all very, very exciting.
It's one thing to learn everything in... A learning setting, it's another thing to apply
in
the real world.
Exactly.
Right?
So, I think I was really lucky. Everything kind of, I had a good tutor who I got on with. And I think then that obviously means he could trust me and relax a bit. And it just created a really good sort of initial learning experience, I suppose. It's really, God, I hope he never hears this because he'll love it. But it was really good. Yeah.
Do you remember any first kind of days or incidents that you kind of felt, right, I'm I know what I'm not that I know what I'm doing, yeah. but I'm going to be all right at this, or I'm going to be good at this.
One thing that's really good is, so when you're in your last few weeks of like the learning, the training school, they take you out. You go down to Euston Station normally, or one of the sort of big London stations. You go out in uniform. You have someone with you, and they put these role plays on, but in public, obviously.
Right.
And that's a really, really good thing, I have to say. Like, I know a lot of people will sort of cope the training that we have because sometimes it's a little bit tedious or something. You know, there's things that could be done differently. But it's called a ROS day. It's like a real officer scenario training or something like that. But, yeah, and they are really helpful because that's where you're essentially dealing with something. No one's telling you, right, you're going to this, you know. No one's telling you what it is. You're just told to go to this location.
That's great.
This is what's there sort of thing. And even less information than what you'd get when you're actually doing the job. So that's really helpful because it's that time when you suddenly go and you're like, okay, I do know how to apply things here. And it's a really big confidence boost. Like, certainly for me, that was a massive thing for me because, like I say, I hadn't done anything before. I hadn't been out in uniform before. So going along and doing that and you sort of go, right, okay, I can do this. It was just a little sort of tick box of, right, okay, still don't get carried away because thankfully that's not really my personality, but it was just a good thing to kind of go,
I can handle this, I know
what I'm doing. I can see an offence and kind of put something to it and know how to deal with it.
So
that was really helpful in terms of, like I say, when we went out, when you're being tutored, a lot of the time it's just you'll have a discussion when you're going to a job of, right, what are you thinking, where, you know, where's your head at, and you can kind of discuss it before you get there. So, but then again, normally you get there and it turns out to be something completely different, but that's always the way.
So what are kind of the most common kind of things that you have to deal with as a London a Met Police officer?
British Transport Police.
Or British Transport Police, sorry.
We're way better, no. it depends. It kind of varies. So obviously previously I was working at London Bridge, and that's like it's basically a hub. So there's always officers there pretty much 24/7. A lot of the time then there's a lot of sort of just public order offence. That's just like shouting and swearing, I guess.
Right, yeah.
Thankfully, there's kind of low-level assaults. At the moment, there's quite a lot of shoplifting going on there because it's all been transformed and there's loads of shops. But,
right, yeah, of course.
But it varies. So I'm working out of Stockwell now, and that's kind of a far more wide range world. Yeah. You know, there's a lot more stuff that goes on, unfortunately, like the sort of stuff you see in the news.
Yeah.
We cover a lot of that. So, I don't know what the kind of most common thing exactly would be, but it's a lot more. It does vary from kind of just location to location, but certainly.
Yeah, I'd imagine because one's a very touristy type location, and one's a very not touristy
location. So like Stockwell's a response post as well, so we cover kind of your Brixtons and all these lovely, lovely London areas that are unfortunately in the news for a lot of the wrong reasons at the moment. Yeah.
Or they were always. When I was a kid growing up in Essex but coming into London a lot, I'd go to Brixton for gigs.
Yeah.
Brixton was at that point the scary place. Yeah. And it seems so ignorant now, but it was like, it's dangerous there.
No, I get that.
And that was the view of the area, and it's got a lot better as it's become kind of a bit trendier and all these kind of things. But still, I think one of the problems that we've had with the gentrification type stuff in East London and now in South London is you get a lot of people who don't realise that these are also areas you need to be a bit careful in. You need to have your wits about you and
absolutely.
Not be allowed drunk or whatever else, because
these
are areas where you may be visiting to buy some really good chicken, but there's people there who, you know, are on the breadline or, you know, have had rough lives and are trying to get by. In whatever way, you know, applicable, but
it's like you say, it is that gentrification, and it is there are kind of okay parts of Brixton, and you know, even Stockwell, it's not on paper, it doesn't look like the most glamorous area, but there are kind of okay parts, but it's just there's a lot that's kind of not great at the moment, I suppose, and like I say again, they're the unfortunate bits that get reported, and they're the things that you see, and obviously as a police officer, they're the things you end up dealing with as well.
Yeah, of course, it's a weird one. I've always said that. Obviously, I've got South London ties, but I feel far more comfortable in South London than, for example, in West London.
Yeah.
Because in West London, like in South London, I might feel as if there's a chance I'm going to get punched in the face. But in West London, I feel there's a good chance someone's going to turn around and go, you're not meant to be here. What are you doing? Can you leave, please? What are
it's
you
true.
Doing in this fancy area?
Fair play.
For some reason, I'm more comfortable with the idea of an incident than a being found out. So, yeah,
I totally get that. Yeah.
It's an odd one. So when was it that you joined? What year
so
did you...
I joined, oh my God, so it would be 4 years this year, so I'm still fairly...
Yeah.
I still feel fairly new, and I guess I am in the grand scheme of things. But yeah, it would have been so 2015, I guess, September 2015.
So you will have only with... You have six months where it's essentially training day, yep. Sarah and Denzel Washington.
Exactly.
So you will have only had a year and a half to 2 years when, in June 2017, yep. when the London Bridge
yep.
attack happened. So, yeah. I mean, that's a huge thing for someone who still feels
yeah.
quite new. So can you kind of talk us through with, you know, in any way you want, with for yeah. the listeners... We've discussed before,
yeah, yeah.
you can go into as much as or as little detail as you want,
yeah.
and as is
yeah,
allowed
yeah.
From
exactly.
You know,
obviously, the inquest sort of in it's going to be in May, start of May. So,
yeah.
in terms of what's kind of not in the public anyway,
yeah.
I can't go into a great
I mean,
detail about that.
But, I'll mention that now that
yeah.
we've been discussing this for a good couple of months now because
yeah.
we wanted to make sure that number one, it didn't clash or cause any disrespect
yeah, yeah.
or issues with the inquest.
Yeah, yeah.
It was okay with. The powers that be.
Yeah, completely.
And, you know, it was okay with you, and we'll get to the timing around it as well because
yeah,
there's
yeah.
a London Marathon thing we
yeah,
want to talk
yeah.
about.
Yeah.
So, but yeah, just to be clear to any listeners, this isn't kind of a, oh, let's have a chat, fuck it. You know, it's kind of, it's been thought
yeah,
out in that
yeah.
way. So, yeah, I guess how did that day play out? That seems such a broad
yeah.
question, but...
Yeah, like I say, I'll have to be slightly sceptical, but
yeah.
It was, it's just... So obviously, I was working with Wayne, who's been in the news a lot because
yeah.
clearly of what happened to him. But he was on my intake as well. So,
right.
and it was that kind of weird thing where we knew each other, but we'd never really worked together very often.
Yeah.
And so we'd been on nights on the Friday, and like I say, it was pretty much the first shift we'd had together, and it was like, oh, we're actually all right. Like, yeah, sort
yeah.
of had a decent shift. We crewed up again on the Saturday night, and yeah, we started at 9 o'clock. And then I think he was slightly late. I mean, I don't know if I should grass him up for that. But yeah, and we, cause, I mean, it'd been Champions League final night. And we, to be honest, we were kind of, I remember we were just chatting about like what we're going to have to eat and if we were going to be able to get in to watch the highlights of the football and stuff like that. And it's just normal. It's,
yeah.
it's that weird thing where, again, I know you work at an iconic location with the Shard and stuff around, but. I don't know. I don't think it's blasé attitude, but I just thought, well, you know, if something happens, you're always reacting to it rather
yeah.
than it kind of being right on top of you and being involved in it.
And also, your job is responding to
exactly.
stuff.
Exactly.
So it's,
exactly.
By the time you realise it's something big,
yeah.
you've probably not got any time to be
exactly.
worrying
so
or thinking about this.
It's
got to be more in hindsight,
exactly
I guess,
that.
Like,
completely.
Wow, last
yeah,
night
yeah.
was nuts.
Completely that. So, yeah, so we've kind of got kitted up. And we was on this like night tube duty at London Bridge, so we were literally just going to pop out, kind of go and see staff, have a chat, have a little wander around, just, you know, be visible. And then, like I say, probably head in for something to eat and try and catch some of the football. And it was literally a case of we left the office, and I just remember we sort of heard this noise, and I didn't know, it wasn't anything untoward. It's Saturday night in London. I genuinely didn't think anything of it. And then... You know, in short, Wayne thought there was a fight going on, so we kind of run down the end of the street, and slowly this whole thing began to unfold, and
yeah,
it kind of turned out, obviously, it was a lot more serious. It took a long time in my head for it to even realise, okay, something bad's going on.
Yeah.
Again, as weird as that sounds, when we're police officers, if someone comes up to you and says someone's been stabbed, you don't suddenly start thinking... Oh, this is like a real, you know, it's a terrorist attack.
Of course.
It was just a case of dealing with what was in front of us. And
yeah. I mean, again,
like I say, yeah.
London on a Saturday night, if someone
yeah.
comes up to you and says someone's been stabbed, they might not have even been stabbed. There
yeah.
might have been something kicking
yeah,
off.
Yeah, exactly.
The misinterpretations.
This is it. Bearing in mind the football had been on, you know, and it hadn't finished that long before.
Yeah.
It doesn't happen often, really, that you get serious, serious football things like that. But, you know, you never know.
Never
it does
know, yeah.
It does happen. So, yeah, I think initially... We just kind of ran into this thing, and I've always said that it's probably a good thing we didn't know what was going on. Had we come out 2 minutes later and had we heard something on the radio of this is what's going on, you kind of approach with a lot more caution, understandably.
Yeah.
Because we didn't know what was going on, we just sort of ran into this situation and just tried to kind of do what we could. I think it was only after our sort of initial, like I say, after Wayne had been injured, and I'd kind of been on the radio again and just, yeah, trying to get more back up.
Yeah.
It was only really after then, and I was kind of walking to try and find the guys again, that it sort of, that was when it hit home, and it was like, okay, something's bad is happening here, because it was just all random. It wasn't a gang thing. It wasn't kind of like a group that, you know, are all together and
it wasn't a clear clash or incident.
Exactly. It was just random, and yeah, that kind of, it was, I remember at the time, I was like, I don't know, so I didn't want to kind of go, oh, look, like on the radio, I didn't want to say, look, I think there's a terrorist attack going on, but I remember saying something along the lines of, like, I think this is something serious, like, and the weirdest thing is it all seemed to go on forever, like,
yeah.
I mean, obviously I'm telling this quite a quick time, but if I kind of went into the whole story, I could be sitting here talking about it for ages, but really and truly, it's only the sort of first 10 minutes that lots was going on.
Yeah.
After that, there was just a lot of kind of doing first aid and just trying to kind of get people out of the cordon and just look after the situation. It's just weird how your brain works. And I think, yeah, I remember the first time I got my phone out, like I say, I know it was like pretty much bang on 10 o'clock when we left the office, because we had a sergeant who was basically, it was his last shift at London Bridge. He was going back to Croydon, I think. So I'd literally called him because he'd brought donuts in, which is thankfully I ate two. Otherwise, I don't know how I would have got through the night. Great sugar kick. But so I'd called him because we were just going to go in and say goodbye basically before he finished. And so I must have looked at my watch or something, knew it was pretty much bang on 10 o'clock. And like I say, it felt like hours had passed. And I got my phone. It was when I had the opportunity, I got my phone out and it was like 10:30.
That's mad,
and it
right?
was the weirdest thing ever. And I texted my missus and was just like, we had a little boy, or we got a little boy, and I knew she'd be asleep anyway, so it wasn't kind of an urgent thing, but I just said, like, I'm okay.
Yeah,
and knew she'd wake up at some point to that, and yeah, but it was...
And that's an interesting thing, I think, that isn't talked about much, is anyone who's in that job, anytime anything like this happens, everyone will assume the worst. I know on that night, my girlfriend has got a really good friend who's in the police in London, and she hadn't heard there's stuff going
exactly,
on, but there was that panic and fear of, well, that's kind of the area he works in or often responds there.
My phone was going mad and it was like, I've got a friend, Kenny, who works at Waterloo. And like I say, cause we had a really good intake. We had a really close group, and we've still got our little WhatsApp group going now.
Yeah.
And so me and Kenny had been talking anyway about maybe trying to meet up. So everybody on our intake, they knew that I was at work at London Bridge.
Yeah.
Kenny wasn't far away. And yeah, we'd been talking about meeting up for a tea. So again, like, I guess as soon as news starts to break, they're all suddenly more concerned.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
Yeah, it was just, it's so surreal. It's little things like, I remember like when I first was telling a story like back, and I had to give a first account obviously on the night to officers. And in my head, it was like so dark.
Yeah.
But yet, when I went back to kind of where it happened, like on a late shift at night, and you kind of look, and it's such a well lit area.
Yeah.
And it's so weird how your brain just focuses on the kind of important bits, and you know, obviously, kind of when there's knives involved, your brain focuses on things like that, not what else is going on. It just cuts the kind of the crap essentially.
Yeah. Yeah.
It was. You just go into autopilot. That's the one thing I've always said. Like, again, because we didn't know what was going on, you're just dealing with what's there, and you just kind of, it was all automatic. I wasn't at any point thinking, I should do this now, I should do that.
Yeah. And that's what's amazing. Yeah. Again, it's the thing. I think Stu summed it up in a drunken slur on the drunk cast, where he was saying it's being someone who's able to see people running in one direction and running the opposite direction.
You know,
and that's
what?
Part of your job kind of
when
thing.
When we join, that's kind of one of the things that they kind of say about is, you know, going towards the things that people are running away from.
Yeah.
I don't know how that kind of clicks in our head, because, like I say, I'm a normal person.
It's such a weird one, though, because it is something
I can genuinely
there.
Sit here and say, had I not been at work, I don't know if I would have done the same thing.
Yeah.
But because I'm working and it's my job, like, you know, I've, obviously, you know, I'm friends with Wayne and Charlie now, the other two officers that were kind of commended.
Yeah.
And I've always said, like, I'm blown away by what Charlie done, because he wasn't at work. He had been out with friends.
Right.
And he then got involved in this situation.
Oh, wow. Like, I wasn't aware of that.
I don't think I would have done that.
Yeah.
I'm not saying I would have run away, but I can honestly say I don't think. And there's no shame in that. So
that's got to be testament to the training, right? I had a guy called Wayne Sharrocks on, who did, we talked about, he's campaigning to raise the age of joining the army, because joined at a young age and it's changed him mentally, irreparably. But one of the things that we discussed, despite him wanting that change and all this, we both kind of had to agree that as harsh and as kind of horrible as the training can be in the army, it's kind of what's needed for the job they then have to go and do. It's not good for when they have to leave and so on and so forth.
Yeah.
But for the job they have to do, and I guess it's a similar thing there. The fact is, you were at work and you've been trained and told how
it's how literally you respond. Something I kind of noticed quite early on with myself, is that you put this uniform on, and I guess it was kind of, I noticed it more in the aftermath. You put this uniform on and you do feel a bit kind of stronger, and you do feel a bit protected, even though it's just a uniform. It is just a uniform, and it's still the same person, but you suddenly feel like a bit more like, okay, I can deal with this.
It's fascinating.
And it was one of those, that was one of the things that really hit me afterwards, is the first time I put my uniform back on, I didn't feel like that. It was difficult. It was a really, I mean, it probably didn't help that I lost a lot of my uniform, because it had to be destroyed, because it was kind of not very tidy, shall we say.
I
just didn't have that kind of, I don't want to say aura, but I didn't feel like, oh, okay, I'm as safe as I was.
There was a lot. Invincibility of it.
Exactly.
Stripped away.
It's weird. I don't want to say, because I think it almost sounds as if I'm, you know, really hyping up this uniform, but it's not. It was just, there's something that it adds to you. I feel like when you're wearing it, you feel that little bit braver, that little bit stronger. I don't know.
Yeah, you've got that responsibility.
But and I guess that was just one of quite a lot of things that I noticed afterwards initially, that it was just like, no, this doesn't keep me safe, essentially. It doesn't.
Yeah.
It's a bit of a reality hit, I guess. Yeah.
So on the night, from what has already been reported, so I assume we're okay to discuss, Wayne was injured, Wayne got stabbed, and the quote in a lot of things was that he said to you to go after him, get him. So you then had to go. And where did Charlie kind of...
Apparently Charlie had come up to us, and I genuinely, again, this is where a lot goes on, I don't remember him coming up to us. I don't remember, like, really talking to him. I think, again, Charlie's memory is a little bit hazy of it sort of as well, because he said that he thought I was a white guy.
Right.
And obviously Wayne's black, I'm mixed race. It's like, But, after this kind of the initial bit, and, you know, the guys had run off, and Wayne initially followed, and when he came back, and that was when I first noticed he had this head injury, basically.
Yeah.
Didn't know he had any other injuries. And I was like, just, dude, you need to sit down. You need to, you know, he's not in any state to kind of be running around and whatnot. Yeah. And, so I was like, you need to sit down. I was on the radio, obviously, just again, requesting for kind of backup and letting them know that an officer had been injured. And he's like, you know, we need to get him. I was like, you sit down and kind of, I'll don't worry, I'll go.
Yeah.
I think I can't remember exactly, but I know we have like a CID officer at London Bridge as well. And I know a lot of those guys like came out really quick, thankfully.
Yeah.
So one of them was kind of with Wayne. So I was just like, look, just stay with him and I'll go and see what's going on, essentially.
Yeah.
And try and find him, because that's, with this kind of incident, you know, even if you're not necessarily engaging, you want to keep eyes on and see what's going on, because then you can report it back to the people better trained to deal with these situations, which obviously what happened in the end.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I didn't see them again after that, but I knew where they'd gone, and it was just about trying to feed that information back, really.
So was that kind of the next step, is kind of everyone's on hand to get as much information through as possible for those who can then intercept and a train to,
exactly.
to intercept
yeah,
and deal
exactly.
with that,
so, I mean, it's,
that
it's,
situation?
It's, obviously, it's very well reported that, you know, the guys ended up being shot.
Yeah.
So, it felt like forever. until backup arrived, like uniform backup. It felt like so long. But I remember, like, when you suddenly see them, and it was that kind of thing of, okay, this is in hand now. It's so weird because I didn't feel, and I guess it's just where you're not thinking straight and you're not thinking properly. It didn't feel like a really dangerous situation.
Right, yeah.
Although my colleague's injured and there's a lot of casualties, it wasn't kind of computing in my head of, this is a really dangerous situation.
Yeah.
And I know I've mentioned before, it was only when you hear the gunshots.
Yeah.
that was when it was like, oh shit, this is real. Yeah, this is real. Yeah. This is like actually happening. And it's just, it's all still very surreal. I couldn't really word it as anything else. It's just the most surreal experience ever, kind of. It feels quite out of body, I guess, in a way, because, as I say, it was also automatic, just reacting to stuff.
Yeah.
But, I don't know, it's just insane.
How long was it until you got to go home after this? And how was that the first time you got to go home? Because that is the point where, I guess, you become Leon again.
Yeah,
You're out of the uniform, you're out of the situation.
I think I knew quite early on that something wasn't right in the back of my head.
Yeah.
And all night, I just thought, I just want to kind of carry on. And like, I've always, I mean, I don't do this to be modest. I'd always kind of try to play down what I'd done because I just tried to do my job.
Yeah.
The only thing that I remember, I look back now and think, I don't know why I'd done that, was when we kind of got Wayne out of that hot zone, essentially, where no ambulances are coming, no help's coming. When we got him out of there, I don't know why I didn't go to hospital or stay with him. But I ended up handing him over to other officers and then going back in and just kind of carrying on. And I don't know. There was no thought process to that. Yeah. There was no, that was weird. So not long after that, I kind of ended up in this weird serial. So in the police, when you've got like football events, you have serials. So it's normally like six officers and a sergeant or something like that.
Right, okay.
So we kind of ended up in this like makeshift group where there was a skipper and a group of officers. And quite early on, he's like, where have you come from? Like, where have you been? Like,
so who are you?
Yeah. I was like, oh, and, you know, I obviously explained, well, I was with Wayne and blah, blah, blah. And I remember he was just kind of like, shit. Are you all right?
Yeah.
And I remember I said to him, I just kind of just want to carry on.
Right.
And he was perfect all night. So, I mean, at that point, he just got me to call through to the control room just to, again, give a pretty brief first account. And again, I'm not being horrible, but I think certain other sergeants might have been like, no, you need to go in. You need to get out of this.
Yeah.
But he let me carry on and I needed to do that.
Yeah, I was going
to
say, that's what you needed at the time, right?
Certainly
to
at that point.
This is work.
It was still a live incident at that point, although, you know, as it turns out, it had kind of, you know, for use of a better term, it had been dealt with.
Yeah.
We didn't know if there was anyone still outstanding and stuff like that. So I just wanted to carry on. And obviously, whilst there's still injured people, you just want to try and help. That's what we're there to try and do at that stage. You just want to try and help. And He was perfect. I've spoken. We've kind of had drunk and emotional chats since. But he got it so right. And it was just, it wasn't bothering me. He wasn't coming up to me going, you okay for 5 minutes. Yeah. We just got it occasionally. You're right. A little arm on the shoulders. Sweet. Like, yeah. So I was kind of out until about 3 a.m.
Right.
And then, I mean, I'm not knocking the job. I think they might have thought I'd gone to the hospital with Wayne.
Yeah.
Otherwise, again, they might have, I imagine they would have been like, we need to get him out of there.
Yeah.
So, about 3 a.m, I remember they were calling up my call sign and I was in the toilet, funny enough, so I didn't hear it. And my colleague kindly informed the control room I was in the toilet. So I come back out and, like I say, we kind of got stood down and relieved and another group of officers kind of took over from what we were doing.
Yeah.
And again, that was when it all started to sink in. So I remember we got taken back in a car or I got taken... Everyone went in a van, and I got put in a car with some people of rank. I genuinely can't remember who they are. I can't remember what rank they were or anything like that. And, that was just when the kind of emotion hit, and it was like, oh, shit, like, damn. And I got a little bit teary in the back of this car. And I was like, I wanted to keep it. It's really weird, but I just wanted to keep it together until I was like in a building where I knew I could just let it go.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And so, yeah, we got back to, we had an office at Waterloo at the time. Got back there and there was about 10 of us all stood in the kind of front area of this building. And you could just tell everyone's kind of looking at each other like, what the fuck?
Yeah.
What have we just been dealing with?
Yeah.
And yeah, literally, it was at that stage. I just broke.
Yeah.
And one of my colleagues, he come and just sort of put me in a little side room, got me a drink, and yeah, and then it was kind of not long after that you start to get debriefs and stuff, and
yeah,
it was just a weird feeling because, like I say, I guess you're just bottling it up.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But again, to get a job done.
Yeah.
You're bottling it up to go, and you're continuing to go. Right, no, I'm in my uniform, I'm on the street.
Yeah.
This is it.
One of the things I've always said as well, and again, it's a little bit of experience, but like a lot of the time as a peace officer, you are kind of acting.
Yeah.
Because no matter what the situation is, you need to go in and you need to try and get just control of it.
Yeah.
And that can be, you know, you might be flapping under the surface, but you've got to just keep that level of, I know what I'm doing, we can control this. And I guess it was that, but just intensified where, you know, I'm in this uniform, just got to get on with it. And then, yeah, even though clearly there was a lot going on in my head. And again, it's little things. Like I didn't realise how much, not knowing how weight, I mean, I knew he was conscious and alive when he'd been kind of taken away. But I didn't know how he was and I didn't really know the extent of his injuries. And like I say, when I got debriefed, literally, so the first thing he said is, Wayne asked how you were. And again, that just broke me. I just crumbled. I was like,
of course.
Oh, my
God.
It was a heavy kind of just weird night.
How was it to get home to your missus and kind of go, I'm all right, they're all right?
Again, I knew after that initial release of emotion and just stress, I guess, kind of, I'd give my first account, I'd had all my uniform seized, I'd had a coffee, had a chat with colleagues at least, and sort of trying to, I don't know, not even get back to normal, but just kind of things had slowed down at that point. And I knew, I'd driven in on that night because I lived in Ashford at the time and the first train was about 8 o'clock. We finished at 7 a.m. and it was like, didn't want to wait for an hour.
Yeah.
So I'd driven in and again, there was sort of the job where, like, you know, we can give you a lift home. I was like, no, I wanted to drive my car home, wanted to get my car home, otherwise it would have annoyed me.
Yeah.
The offer was there, if someone drive my car, I was like, no, it's fine. Yeah. Like, I just want to, but I knew getting back to, like, my ex-missus now, it's unfortunate, but right. I'm sure we'll touch on that. And my little boy, I was like, I knew that was just going to, yeah, it was, just went in and again, just got home and broke down again.
Yeah.
I know, like, I was knackered by that point. I think I probably didn't get home till about 9 o'clock in the morning. And the thing that I was really scared of is I could remember what I'd seen, remembered what I'd dealt with, but at the same time, I didn't know if there was anything in the back of my head. And you're kind of always aware that potentially, you know, you might not be able to sleep. People have it where, you know, they can't sleep or they have flashbacks and things like that. And I remember that was the thing that I got home and had my little breakdown, had a chat with my ex-partner. And then it was kind of, I went up to bed and I just remember sitting there thinking, I don't know if I'm going to have to sleep. And it was scary and weird, but yeah, I managed to kind of nod off for a couple of hours and like almost the relief of when I woke up, I thought, oh, okay. It's like a tick in that box of, right, okay, I'm okay-ish.
Yeah. I'm still here.
Yeah. And then I guess then it was just, Again, I felt all right, but again, with time, things started to unfold, I guess, a little.
And how is that? I mean, before we go into any after effects type thing, I want to be clear that at no point are we going to be shitting on anyone, or you know, it's all of these things are so complex and so case by case and individual that even with the best support systems, things can't always just be all right.
Nah.
You know, it's crazy and unique situations.
Yeah.
So how did it kind of unfold as the weeks went on, I guess, or as the months went on even?
Like I say, initially it was always just this thing of I was okay. I remember like the amount of times obviously people come up to me, how you doing, like what happened, and it was always, I was never good, but yeah. I was always like, I'm okay.
Yeah.
And that felt true.
It's such a strange and standard answer, isn't it?
Yeah.
Because okay, as you said, it's not good.
No, exactly.
It's also not bad. And
exactly.
It's kind of just, it's nothing. You're not learning anything there.
Like in the initial few days and stuff and weeks after, like, I was still figuring out how I was to a certain extent. And like I say, it was, you know, the first time I put uniform back on, it was seeing how that would make me feel. And I've described it before as like, it was like I had this blank piece of paper. And every time I sort of done something like put my uniform on or go back on patrol, it was like a tick box.
Yeah.
And that's kind of all I was going through. And it was just, I guess, making sure I am okay in these situations. And so it was just slowly kind of figuring things out. Again, I don't really know how. I knew something was different about me, but I didn't know exactly what. And I felt okay. And then, it was kind of slowly after a few weeks, I didn't notice it, but I wasn't really eating.
Right.
And I'd sleep, but wake up and just be knackered like all the time. I could get the best night's sleep and I'd be tired. And you just start to notice certain things aren't right. And like I say, there was the obvious things anyway, like I say, about with the uniform and not feeling that. But it was just, I just started to notice things were off, and I just was, I'd get really upset for kind of no reason.
Yeah.
There was no trigger, there was no reason for it, but I'd suddenly just have this like weight or like a cloud almost just hanging over you, and you just suddenly feel shit.
Yeah.
And there was no obvious reason that I could see for it as such. I thought I was kind of dealing with things okay. And then I guess slowly things just got worse. So I'm trying to think now. It would have been maybe late July or September time. I was living in Ashford.
Yeah.
The good thing about the British Transport Police is we're that kind of nationwide force.
Yeah.
So we've got a response place in Ashford, which is, again, where I'd been tutored. So it was a case of I had the opportunity to go back there for 3 months, which I thought, okay, that might be a really good idea. That might help me being closer to home.
Yeah.
I'd had a little bit of time off, but again, it's kind of my attitude now. And I don't, maybe with hindsight, it was the wrong thing to do, but I just wanted to try and get back to normal.
Yeah.
And that meant going to work and doing my job. So, like I say, the opportunity.
I guess it's kind of trying to underplay it
to yourself so
that you can go, no, it's all right.
Yeah. Again, it kind of helped that there wasn't much attention on me. I was quite happy with that. I was quite happy to just get on and kind of be normal, and the people who knew my involvement knew, and the people that didn't, you know, didn't really matter to me. So like I say, had the opportunity, went down to Ashford, and to be honest, that was when it got really bad. And I was really lucky at London Bridge. My skipper, Muller, I'm good friends with him, and he's always looking out for me. And I remember he sort of said this, like, must have been not long before I went to Ashford, but he's like, something's not right with you.
Right.
And again, I felt it myself because I'm quite, it's my colleagues will completely vouch for this, I'm a bit of an extrovert, I'm loud in the office, I'm a bit weird, but I feel like you need to be a bit fun because sometimes it's a heavy job.
Yeah.
And I knew there were times where I felt like I was putting on an act.
Right.
Even in front of my colleagues, and I'd sort of do something and in my head think, why did you do that? So, he had said to me, like, I think you might need to speak to somebody. So I went down to Ashford and it kind of, I don't know what it was, but it just got a bit worse. Things just started to feel rubbish. And then I kind of, like I say, started to realise, okay, I'm sort of suffering from a bit of anxiety and stuff here.
Yeah.
And I mean, to be brutally honest, it felt like that anxiety just stemmed from me being at home.
Right.
And I was pushing my wife away.
Yeah.
I just didn't want to be at home. Yeah. We had our little boy, and I just, I really struggled. And I still remember there was once when, again, her mum, her family are amazing.
Yeah.
And her mum had come down, obviously, just to help out because, you know, she couldn't do it all by, Mrs. couldn't do it all by herself. And, I wasn't probably, I mean, even, I don't even realise how bad I was now, but I was probably a fucking nightmare.
Yeah.
And so her mum was down helping. I remember I was upstairs and I was getting changed. And for no reason, I just felt like they were kind of talking about me and had the hump with me.
Right.
And I just had to get out. And like, again, I remember I think I just got out of the shower and I was getting dressed. And Sasha come up to the bedroom and she's like, you okay? And I was just like, no, like, I've got to get out. And I just had to get out of the house and just walked off and went walking for like 2 hours. And
wow.
It's just, I didn't even realise that I was really not good then. Like, I can look back now and go, shit, man, that's not normal.
It's tough when these things are in your head because they will then start to manifest and be self-realising as such, because if you start acting, if you think people are acting strange towards you, then you'll start to act a certain way towards them, which will cause them to be a bit, is everything all right? And you'll be like, well, why are you asking? Do you know what I mean? It starts to make it a reality
in
itself.
It's that thing, again, now I can look back and be like, man, that was nonsense. But it was such a like contradiction, because I knew I wasn't my normal self.
Yeah.
But I thought I was okay. And so you just kind of, I just thought I'd just get on with it, just carry on.
It's a weird balance, right? Because you should be kind of, you can also tell yourself, well, of course I'm not my normal self.
Yeah.
This huge thing's happened, so it's quite right. So it's finding the balance of how far from your normal self.
Yeah.
Because I said, you wouldn't, it would be even more unusual if you'd just,
all
that happened, and then you're going, all right, cool.
Which is what I tried to do, and then suddenly realised that's not very possible. Yeah.
When did you kind of start to realise, and what action were you able to take, I guess?
I mean, I've got to kind of go into that more as well, because I think it's not fair on Sasha to not mention it. Like, I really let her down, and I was pushing her away, and clearly she's a person who I needed to be talking to, and she knew I wasn't right, and she tried so hard to kind of help me.
Yeah.
And I just pushed her away and just essentially, you know, I got to be really honest about it, I destroyed her life, because, you know, I was supposed to be the strength as well that she needed. And, you know, we had our little boy was really little still at that time. He's only a year and a few months. And then I made mistakes, and I went off and kind of went off with other people or another person. And I want to be honest about that, because, like I say, I owe that to her. It's horrible. I was just a horrible person. And she fought and fought and fought. And I've always said it, like, I got married for the right reasons, and everything we'd done was for the right reasons. And again, I didn't realise what was in my head felt like, oh no, this is normal.
Yeah.
This is fine to be doing it. And fucking hell, man, it wasn't. It really wasn't. And it
sounds as if, as well, if it's going to be a really weird area, because if purely from the incident things aren't right, but you're telling yourself it's fine, it's okay, and just going on, then you're building that illusion.
Exactly.
So then when you start acting in an inappropriate way, you'll be telling yourself, it's right, it's all right, it's fine. It's the same, it's an extension of the same thing that you've been telling yourself that lie to try and cope, because you're going, no, it's fine, when it's not. That then becomes a blanket thing over anything. Anything you do, you can go, it's fine, I'm going through some stuff, it's fine. It gives you, that excuse.
Yeah, completely.
To act up.
So, like I say, I kind of I'm sure I'll kind of go into that a bit more in a while. But, so as I say, my sergeant tied in, or my sergeant from London Bridge tied in with the sergeant I had at Ashford.
Yeah.
And they were able to sort of arrange counselling, which was all through work. Again, and it was helpful in that it was good to just get everything off my chest.
Yeah.
I hadn't been doing it. Like I say, I hadn't really been talking. I hadn't been talking to my wife at the time. My best friends, I just didn't talk to. I didn't say anything. We would talk about things, but I didn't tell them anywhere near enough. I spoke to colleagues, and that was quite helpful because I was genuinely honest with them. But again, it's different when they don't know you like your best friends do. But it's always that thing where I was justifying it in my head of, oh no, they've got a neutral point of view. They can give the best feedback. And it's like, No, that was really stupid.
It's a weird combination because I think the beauty of counselling and the Samaritans and all these other options is it is easier to talk to people you don't know.
Yeah,
in many ways. Even with that slight distance of a work colleague, because it takes a bit of pressure off and you don't feel embarrassed or feel like you're letting anyone down or any of these crazy things that go through your head in those extreme moments. But at the same time, man, there's nothing like having a mate that you can talk to and that can tell you how you're different or can call you out on things
that don't seem right. And I think that was always the thing, like when I first started having counselling, obviously the counsellor, she doesn't know what I was like before.
So
I can sit there and get everything off my chest and tell her how I'm feeling and tell her what I'm thinking. But without her knowing me, there's only so much advice you can give and there's only so much you can really kind of definitely tell you.
Yeah, of course.
Again, hindsight's a beautiful thing, isn't it?
And
I know that now, that I've done the wrong things in certain ways. But, so I skipping ahead a bit now, I guess, but I'd had that first bit of counselling, which was sort of 8 sessions, I think, roughly, something like 6 or 8. When that ended, by this point, I wasn't in my marital home anymore. I was staying at my mum's. And again, then I can't remember exactly how it came about, but it was like, I think I, at that point, was starting to realise things aren't great. So I think I spoke to my sergeant again then and said, like, I think I need a bit more help here.
Yeah.
And it's because I remember when we had like Christmas was a really difficult time because to be fair, actually, at the time, to Sasha, she really wanted me to be with Elijah and kind of, Elijah's my little boy.
Yeah.
And, you know, she was trying really hard to kind of keep things together and hold the family together, essentially. And I just remember I had this huge anxiety that I didn't feel like I could be around her family at Christmas, which...
Right.
There was no... They had no issue with me.
Yeah.
And, you know, Christmas was it's about family,
yeah,
man.
Yeah, of course.
And yeah, no, I was so I just didn't feel like I could be around everybody and it was really hard and I remember kind of having a bit of a breakdown night. I was just again, I was drinking.
Yeah.
It's so mad because I'm not a massive drinker.
Yeah.
But and again the excuse was in my head probably was a bit of it's Christmas. But I was going out on my own and just drinking and getting upset and just winding myself up and making things worse.
Yeah.
And I remember
in those situations, it's an escape from yourself, right? If a lot of the anxiety is going on in your head, then drinking or whatever
little bit,
will be kind of.
It's crazy to think that I was still functioning at work as well. Like, I wasn't doing anything wrong at work.
Yeah.
But on the outside, it was just chaos. And I remember one of my counselling sessions, she was like, it's quite chaotic. Like, and again, I didn't really, at that point, I was like, oh, it's just normal. This is what I do. This is how it is. But again, it was only really when I went on to my second counsellor, things I would say started to get a little bit better.
Right. Because that's one of the interesting things or one of the toughest things with counselling. I mean, as we touched upon, you can be being kept an eye on wonderfully, but if you don't happen to be talking to the right person
completely.
Or whatever, then it's not as easy as that. And the sad part is a lot of people will try it once and go, oh, it's not for me.
No, exactly.
And the good thing here is that you did it once and it wasn't quite right. It was helping, but it wasn't quite right.
Yeah.
And then you went on to a second counsellor and that's when you kind of had more
So that was helpful. With counsellors, I can't even give it a blanket way, but certainly with my first counsellor, it was just me talking.
Yeah.
And one of the things I always remember is, as a police officer, if you're interviewing someone, you're kind of encouraged to not fill that pause.
Yeah.
So if there's a gap, like, let the person you're interviewing fill that. And I knew when I was going to counselling, I was being honest, and I was saying everything I needed to say, but this woman would just like want me to fill the pause, and it was very frustrating because I'm sitting there thinking, I know what you're doing, but I haven't got anything else to say. I need you to say something now.
That's mad and, if they're using the technique that you've been training. Yeah. It's like, I know what this is, but I'm fine, I'm finished.
And she would and it would never happen. Thankfully, the second counsellor I had, she did, and she would be like, okay, you need to do this, or you need to stop doing that. Yeah. And that started to help things. And again, I think at one point, again, I thought, oh, I'm okay now. And then it just... you're just looking at it and it suddenly kind of clicks. You're like, oh, not. And again, that was only really as it came up to the year anniversary. And I thought, again, I started thinking I was okay, but I think it was the week before, or maybe 2 weeks before, there was Champions League final night again. And weirdly enough, and it's, I felt comfortable with it, otherwise I wouldn't have gone, but one of my best mates was having a kind of stag do meal in Borough Market.
Wow.
I know. And I remember speaking to Wayne when I was going, because he's a Liverpool fan and they were obviously playing. I remember speaking to him. I was like, how are you feeling about the service next week and stuff? And he was fine. I was like, I'm going to be honest, mate. Like, I'm not feeling particularly great. And again, I went along and I wouldn't have been myself at all. I know I can look back now at that even and think I wouldn't have been myself. And I remember how hard the kind of... it was just, it was weird. And I think I had an early... I didn't stay out very late. I wasn't, again, didn't drink, just kind of... but, yeah, and I kind of look back at that and think, I probably shouldn't have gone, to be honest. Yeah. It probably would have been better. I'd just be like, guys, this is a bit weird.
It's a tough...
And like I say, and then the following week was the year anniversary since it happened. And I went along to the service at Suffolk Cathedral. And, there's a lady at work who's kind of in charge of the welfare of officers, and I remember she came up to me then and was like, is there anything we can do? And that was when it was like, look, yeah, I'm not in a great place again.
Yeah.
And then that led to basically, again, I've got to be really honest, because a lot of people will knock job, especially within the BTP, a lot of them will kind of knock, but they really have been so supportive and they've really looked after me as much as they can. And so, like I say, it was from that I had some therapy, and that was really... a massive turning point in terms of kind of, you know, where I am now.
That's great.
Yeah, that was, again, it gives you those kind of mechanisms in how to deal with when you're feeling crap, because it happens, and that's been hugely important to me.
Well, that's it. I think a massive thing that gets overlooked is that, again, feeling crap and all these things are natural.
Yeah,
it's finding
exactly.
out how you deal with them when they come. If we're kind of... taught that when you're having the down moments, you've failed in some way, or you've fallen off, you've gone back down that route, and then that's going to keep you there.
Yeah.
Whereas if you're like, no, I will be back there at some point,
but
I know how to deal with it and how to
completely
counter it.
It was just awesome that initially when I was in therapy, I mean, one of the things that was kind of suggested to me was that my marriage probably would have broken down eventually.
Right.
And at the time, that was really cool to hear, because I thought, okay, I can accept that now.
Yeah.
Now I look back and think, no, that wasn't right.
Like, right.
I don't believe that.
Yeah.
But at the same time, at that point, it helped, I guess. And as a whole, it's been so beneficial, and the kind of things they gave me to take away, the little bits of advice and the sort of exercises essentially that you can do to kind of help with the down days. It's been vital, because, you know, I'm not ashamed to say the lows were, you know, it was really bad. There was times when I was genuinely considering taking my own life, genuinely doing it. And it was only really after the therapy that it was okay.
Genuinely life-changing is literally a literal description of it, right? Because it gives you those tools and mechanisms to go, right, I can take control of this a little bit.
The simple fact is, before I had therapy, like I say, the depression was as bad as, I was considering taking my own life.
Yeah.
That hasn't happened since, touch wood, thankfully. Yeah. It's not even crossed my mind. And
that's great.
And I know in myself that, you know, sometimes there's shitty times, and sometimes I'm not having a great time with work or life or whatever, but it never gets that bad anymore.
That's great to hear.
I don't get carried away. I still, like I say, it's about remembering those techniques and those exercises and everything like that, because, you know, I don't want to slip off and slip down again because
completely. It's, yeah. it's being aware, I guess.
Yeah,
right? Aware that it's. I mean, it's weird to compare it to AA or anything else, but it's being aware that it's a constant thing. It's, you know, you
absolutely
need to keep on top of your mental
absolutely
health
yeah
forever now. And again, it's the easy comparison: physical health. If you get in good shape, you don't just go, all right, I'm in good shape
now. Stop
now.
Yeah.
Stop.
No, completely.
You have to keep on top of
absolutely
that if you want to maintain that. And you might not keep at the same level the whole time. You're going to have ups and downs, but it is something that needs maintaining and you need
absolutely
to be aware of that, I guess.
Yeah.
So with all of that, like with the journey that you went through with the ups and downs, how was it? I believe it was kind of after a lot of that journey that you then got kind of the spotlight on you, I guess, and got kind of to go to I mean to Palace and to the Palace, I guess. So both to kind of get awards and get presentations. How was all that? Because that's not what I always say with awards in TV or music or anything else. That's not why you do any of it, but it's also not always a bad thing to have someone say, you're all right, mate, you've done good there, you've done something good. So how was that? Did it feel good, or was it, did you feel...
It's weird, because so 2 days after the incident, I had the opportunity to go to the like Met Command Centre in Lambeth, and basically we had Charles and Camilla were coming. We weren't told who at the time, but it was like, Charles and Camilla are going to come down, or some royals are going to come down and just kind of have a chat with a lot of the first responders. Again, that was from kind of the ambulance service as well, and the Met and the City Police. And genuinely, I went along because it just felt like one of those things where I couldn't say no, to be honest. I mean, I'm a normal person, so meeting whoever it was from the royals, I was like, okay, that's pretty crazy. But it was too soon. Like, it really was. I hope it doesn't sound like I'm being ungrateful, but I just didn't enjoy it. And I had a chat with Charles and Camilla, but it was just, it's not something it's not something I'm going to remember, because it was just, it was too soon. Two, 3 days afterwards, it was just like, nah, it wasn't fun. So again, obviously time passed and we found out. It was such a shock for me when this letter comes through the post. And I was literally just going to work, actually. And I picked up this letter and it looked a bit weird and official. So what's that about then? It was, saying that you were kind of been put forward by the Cabinet Office, I think, to kind of the Royals. I don't even know. For this award, and that it was approved and whatnot, and it was going to be announced. And it was just, it was weird because, not even not knocking it, but you know, a lot of the attention had been on Wayne, a lot of the attention had been on Charlie for completely understandable reasons. And I know a lot of people at work didn't even, again, people I you know don't work closely with, they didn't even know I'd been there on the night or anything like that. So it was a shock to me anyway, because I wasn't expecting anything like that at all. And like you say, I was just doing my job. It was mad. And then the day at the Palace, Christ, it was, the good thing is they really relax you. They kind of make it as smooth a process as possible. And it was great because I had my mum, my dad and my sister with me.
Oh, wow.
My parents don't particularly get on very well, but it was nice that they put previous history aside.
Unifying moment.
Yeah, I mean, and do you know what, actually? That was probably the best thing about the whole day, is seeing how proud they were.
Yeah.
Because I don't want to sound blasé, but I still don't think I've done anything that amazing. Yeah. I don't. But for them to be able to sit there and kind of see it and get that, you know, for them to be able to come to Buckingham Palace was like, oh man, that's pretty cool to be able to drag my parents along to that.
Yeah.
So I think we joked about it, myself, Wayne and Charlie. It was almost as surreal as the night itself, because it's just like, we're all pretty normal. We're not meant to be meeting the Queen at Buckingham Palace. Like, that's not meant to happen.
It's quite nuts, right?
It's just weird. But the good thing about that is I had that, and then I went back to work the next day on early turn, and it's just like, back to normal again.
Just
like,
back to the regular.
Yeah, I like being fairly regular. I can't say normal because no one at work will accept that I'm normal. But
it's one of the most amazing things that I think certainly I've learned in life, is no matter what crazy situation happens, the next day, it's all back to normal.
Yeah.
It's like I've lived in the same town my whole life, yeah. And I've had some mad things where I'm like, I've got to be on set with this person or do a gig with this person. And then the next day, I guess I need to pop to Tesco's. Yeah. I'll get some stuff.
Put the bins out.
It's
not
yet.
Unless
you get to a Johnny Depp type, that kind of thing, where life is then changed completely. But it's like, in general, most things that you would see as this huge deal, it all just, it happens then, and then it stops happening.
Yeah. Well, it's exactly it. And I know a lot of people at work were kind of like surprised when we went, oh, I thought you were going to have a day off. I was like, no, it's just, let's just go back to normal again. Yeah. It was, as I said kind of earlier, I touched on even after the kind of the attack, I wanted to get back to normal. And it's the same really with that. Like, it's just just go back to normal.
Completely. So how was it to go to the other palace, Selhurst Park?
The real palace.
Yeah.
Yep. Yeah, man.
This is the issue, because obviously a lot of fans will know I'm a Millwall fan, and Palace and Millwall aren't the best of friends.
I'm
but
pretty
still,
sure
we
you
can,
dug me out for that. The second message you sent me was digging me out for my choice of football team.
Yeah,
so,
it was. The first one was very humbled and lovely, and the second one was, the palace thing. But, yeah.
Yeah.
So how was that? Because that means
that
a lot
was,
as well.
That
does
was really
mean
cool. Again, it's weird because things like that, as you know, going to Selhurst Park, like I do it a lot.
Yeah.
So that was kind of going on the pitch was really special, and I can't compare it to meeting the Queen, but at the same time, it was like, I'm on the pitch of Selhurst Park, and that was good.
It's special because it's something that's within familiarity as well.
Exactly.
Because going to to Buckingham Palace to meet the Queen, that's nothing that's ever on your radar.
That's...
But sitting at Palace, you've looked at that pitch your whole life. You've looked at all that.
That was awesome. And again, it was we kind of got a whole day. The club kind of looks after us in the morning, and I think I was on nights as well, actually, just then. So I was pretty knackered. But I took my stepdad along because he's the reason I'm a Palace fan.
Yeah.
So you can blame him. But it was cool to be able to just treat like people and like my near and dear and take him along. That's mad. It was mad. Yeah. And funny, like I say, I've got they gave me a signed shirt, and that's literally just the medal from the Queen is just sat next to that. So I don't know what else to do with it. So just, go with a shirt.
I love it. That's perfect.
Quite a place.
So let's talk now as we'll start to wrap things up.
Yeah.
Let's talk about the London Marathon and who you're raising money for. In that, because that's kind of an interesting one, because it all comes round. Because
it
was a guest that was on Hardcore Listing, and so do you want to talk about that a little bit?
So I mean, I've always wanted to run a London Marathon. It's like a bucket list thing. 5 years ago, I had a charity spot, but I ruptured my ACL playing football, so I couldn't. And then the third place next year was when I was still having like the recovery, so kind of lost that. So basically, I haven't milked this whole medal thing at all, but it was like, really want to do the marathon, and I'd like to try and raise some money. And it was always in my head, I wanted to do it for some sort of kind of mental health charity. Yeah. I was looking at like Mind have a blue light section. And so that was the first thing that had, excuse the pun, sprung to mind. And so I knew about PTSD 999 because I had a sergeant who had kind of, again, when I was having a crap time, sort of said, you probably should go there. But it was at the club night, I got chatting to Stu, and I was aware again that they'd had Gary from PTSD 999 on Hardcore Listing, and I hadn't listened to it because I knew it was going to be a pretty heavy one.
It's a tough one, right?
Gary has previously worked in the BTP as well, so I guess he's got a lot of kind of understanding about the kind of things we deal with on the railway. So I knew it was going to be a difficult listen. I spoke to Stu about it, and I was like, right, okay, I'm going to definitely listen to it this week. So I did a couple of days, it might have been the next day after, a day or two after, listened to it, and it just was massively impactful for me. And anyone who's listening to this who hasn't, certainly officers-wise, and that's, you know, including from fire service and ambulance service, I would really suggest you do. It just blew me away, man.
It's hell of an episode.
It's
really amazing. And
you don't expect it on Hardcore Listing.
No, exactly. It's weird when they go highbrow and emotional.
Yeah, man.
But because what it is, so PTSD 999 is a support service for people in the services.
Yeah, non-serving kind of families as well, of people who, you know, obviously it's PTSD as well, but it's, you know, if you're having a crap time, they're not going to say no to helping you.
Yeah, yeah.
And well, hopefully, in the very soon coming weeks, they're going to have an official charitable status, because at the moment it's kind of just an organisation and they're doing what they can.
Yeah.
But, yeah, listen, obviously, having kind of gone through my own stuff, it just hits home how important it is to have someone like that. And I think the whole blue light section of it makes a massive difference, because... Yeah.
And it's for, as I said, I think it was key as well that you said serving or not serving.
Yeah, yeah,
that completely. Can be the tough thing. If you've left the service,
yeah,
it can be tough to kind of be going back to there to get any help or guidance,
because
you're not there anymore.
Exactly.
So it's that thing of going, right, no, it doesn't just stop when you leave.
And I think the whole thing is, like, it's one thing that I noticed every time I kind of spoke to people in that aftermath of London Bridge is, you know, I'd be talking about, you have that conversation of what happened, how you feeling. And so many times the reaction of people was, oh, well, I know it's not comparable, but I had this thing.
Yeah.
And they would talk about how it affected them. And I quickly realised that it doesn't matter how well publicised that incident is or how big a thing it is. Like, if you have a traumatic experience, it's a traumatic experience, and it's going to, and if that affects you, that affects you. And like I say, kind of tying it in with PTSD 99, that's what that's all about. It's not about kind of going, oh, it's only a little thing, I shouldn't talk about it. It's like, no, if something's bothering you, if something's affecting you, then do something about it.
Yeah, there's no ranking in...
Completely,
your despair, it's...
And it's exactly that thing, like I say, because I was talking to so many people about my own thing, I just got these little stories from other people, and you realise how much it's there.
There's probably a good chance that you pushed yours down a bit because... You know, you didn't go through what Wayne went through. There's a lot of these things where you've said, every 10 minutes or so, you've said, I don't feel I really did anything. So that's clearly a thing there that you feel there's other people that went through worse. And that could be a reason that you will push things down or not address it.
Probably true, man. I hadn't really looked at it. I mean, it's not an intentional thing to kind of play it down, but clearly... There were people who were more affected because, lives were lost
and
so many people were injured. But, I say it just blew me away then when you're having these conversations and people just kind of not wanting to compare their thing to it. And it's just like, okay, there's a lot of people that have a hard time. And again, I know from the aftermath of the whole London Bridge thing, and again, this isn't a dig at the job, but there were a lot of people that struggled a lot. And weren't getting the same support I was. It was kind of easy for the job to look after me because they knew what I'd done and they'd known what I'd seen. For other people who have responded, and there's hundreds and thousands of people that would have responded from forces and LAS and stuff. Mm. It's a difficult thing. It's a difficult thing for the job to reach those people.
Of course.
And so I think again, that's why this is such an important organisation.
It's such a broad net to try and catch everyone. Yeah. And equally, however involved you were or involved or not, a thing like that happening that changes how your work is.
Yeah, yeah.
Because you don't know. That wasn't. No one expected that.
Exactly.
So that suddenly puts everyone
in a different mindset.
In a different
And so, like I say, it was just it just all kind of. Hit home of there's a lot of people that kind of need help and probably need to talk to somebody. Mm-hmm. And it's weird, like, again, I wish I had done something sooner, because had I done that, then I probably would still be married. You never know, of course. But had I got the right help sooner, had I really spoken to someone properly sooner, things might have been different. And it's just all about that. And I'm like I say, I will talk to people. And I know there's a lot of people that aren't as outgoing as I am. And therefore, you just bury it away. And the festive period, I know from stories that that's a real difficult time for a lot of police officers.
Yeah.
I can't speak for every service, but I know there's a lot of officers that kind of were in a dark place and took the wrong choice, and like I say, I just want to raise as much awareness now of PTSD 999, because even if, or obviously I'm fundraising for the marathon, but even if it's not about giving the money, it's about raising the awareness of, there's someone here that can help. And hopefully it's going to do some good, because that's what I want to do now. we've had this really shit event.
Yeah.
So now I want to try and make something good come from that.
And find the positive out of it.
Exactly.
Oh, well, that's perfect. I'll kind of wrap things up there, unless there's anything else you wanted to...
No. To address. I don't know. I'll probably leave and be like, oh, I should have said that.
It's always the way, man.
But no, like I say, it's just all about, it's almost a cliche thing, but just if anybody is having a shit time, just talk.
And again, I think it's particularly in the service as well, is you've got to be strong. You've got to be the strong people there, and that means it can be hard to acknowledge at times when you're struggling or when you're not feeling strong.
Yeah, I mean, look, part, it's not the problem, but it's like I said earlier, like you put this uniform on and it's an act. Everything that's going on away from that job, you are putting away.
Yeah.
And this, again, I know from speaking to kind of ambulance staff as well, it's a similar thing for them. You know, they could be dealing with someone who they know is not in a good way, but you have to... put on this front, you have to, and it's the same in the police, and I'm sure it's the same in the fire services, that you know you have to maintain that kind of act of this is, we've got this under control and it's all right, and you know doing that a lot can kind of cause problems in the long run.
I mean, it's so easy and common to self-medicate with booze or with all these other things, and you know, I get it.
Yeah.
You know, I get that. I don't think it's right, but I fucking understand it. It's a tough thing, but hopefully, with the raising awareness from the marathon, from the podcast, all that kind of thing, is that there's no weakness in getting help. There's a strength in getting help.
Completely. You know?
There's a weakness in, not a weakness, but the problem is when you're not addressing it, the strongest thing to do is go, look, this isn't all right. I need to...
It's certainly still that thing a little bit in the police where it's macho.
And, of course.
You know, I get it. It's not me, but I do get it.
And you're going to have that opinion of, again, comparing. Yeah. Oh, well, if Mark isn't struggling, Mark might be. He might be looking at you and going, well, if Tom ain't struggling.
And again, it's always that thing then of, oh, but my thing's only a little thing that's bothering me. So it's not. If it's bothering you, then it's just as important as what anyone else is going through. Yeah, so,
completely.
Yeah, man, that's what it's all about.
So where can people sponsor you for the marathon? I'll put links as well.
Yeah, so I mean, I've got my Just Giving page, which it's some really long, complicated link.
Yeah.
But that's like, I guess that's on my Twitter page, which is LeonMCL88, I think, and Instagram.
Yeah.
Like, I'm just posting it as much as I can. Again, PTSD's 999's media team are kind of doing their bits and pieces as well. So I'm just trying to push it as much as I can, to be honest.
That's perfect. Well, thank you very much for coming on and chatting and being
so
open about it all.
Yeah, that's cool.
I believe you're going to do a hardcore listening as well at some point, which will probably be a lot less heavy and stressful.
Exactly, man. Like, that was
because that's what we discussed. Like, me and Stu were saying, well, I'll do the heavy one.
Yeah,
the heavy one, and you have him on to just dick about.
Well, that's it. Then at least I can kind of not that this isn't my normal personality, but this is, you know, it's a. It's a heavy subject, whereas at least I can kind of be, work, Leon. What can I say?
Yeah, but I genuinely appreciate you coming on. And said this was something that, you know, I approached you about, and we kind of discussed if it was right and how to approach it. So I'm delighted that you decided it was the right platform, and I appreciate it. So thank you very much.
Thanks for having me, man. Thank you.
You've been listening to Scroobish Pip's Discretion Pieces.
There we go. That was Leon. Amazing dude. Thank you for tuning in, and thank you to Leon for being so heart-wrenchingly open. I didn't expect a lot of that. I didn't know any of his home life story and things like that, and he wanted to be open and take... It's mad that I was bringing him on to talk about all the things he did that he should be proud of, and his focus was talking about the ways in which he fucked up, you know, the things he did wrong, the mistakes he made. That's a testament to Leon as a character. So I said at the beginning I'd tell you a little bit about the song Cowboy. I didn't want to fill the start up because some people just want to get onto the interview. But Cowboy, I said,
was on mine and Dan Lissac's second album, The Logic of Chance, available now on iTunes, Spotify. Cowboy had a music video made for it, so it's free on YouTube. It's the one true story I've written. In general, all my lyrics, I base them on true emotions and true experiences, but I draw from those true emotions and true experiences and write fiction. I make up a new fictional story based on the true events of my life or of the lives of those close to me. But Cowboy was the one that's based on a true story, and it's based on a story about my nan, and it's about when. I mean, there's no way to sugarcoat this. It's based on about when someone attempted to rape my nan. And that sounds like a terrible subject for a pop song, but honestly, the way she handled it, the actions she took, have always been inspirational to me. And I thought it was a hell of a story to share. I mean, interestingly, with International Women's Day last week, I posted about a load of my favourite episodes with women on, and last year, episode 192, the Mother's Day special, I had my mum on the podcast to talk about her mum, and we talk about that story in detail that we've never talked about before, really. You know, it's one that I always knew, but it's not like we sit down and catch up over it all. So to hear my mum's outlook on all of it was amazing. So yeah, go and check that out if you get a chance. That's all I need to tell you about. As said, the Stretch and Pieces podcast Rewind on Monday at patreon.com/ScroobiusPip. And yeah, oh yeah, I mean, really, we talk about it at the end of the podcast there, but Leon is running the London Marathon. I'll share the links and stuff when this podcast goes out. I'll make sure I put the links in tweets or Facebook or Instagram. If you see the posts and the links aren't there, just give me a nudge. I'll chase Leon up and get the links and put them in there at ScroobiusPipYo on all of those platforms, or just ScroobiusPip on Facebook. Yeah, please go and chip in and get involved, because he's doing this for, yeah, an amazing cause. And Leon is going to be on Hardcore Listing, as we touched upon, talking about stuff. He's picking his top five. I believe the last time I spoke to him, his plan was to do his top five American Office moments. Or maybe it was top five pranks that Jim and Pam have played on Dwight. Something along them lines. But he'll also be talking about doing the marathon for PTSD 999 and raising money for those guys. So, yeah, it's been a hell of an episode. Please, as I mentioned in the intro, please shout about it online if you enjoyed it. I'll tell you, actually, as we're at the end here, I'll tell you who next week's guest is. Let me just check. I've got so many recorded at the moment, man. The people over at the Patreon obviously get to see each time I record one and who the guest is, and they have to wait ages for some of these. Oh, next week is Johan Harry, who's an amazing author, and we talk about the roots and causes of depression and mental health issues and some of the possible solutions within our society and within ourselves as individuals. So, yeah, hell of a chat. You're going to really enjoy that one. So tune in next week for that. But until then, I've been Scroobius Pip, and this has been the Distraction Pieces podcast, episode 257.
Small details are big surfaces. Tight corners are odd shapes. Flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with five different spray patterns, so you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.